You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 12th of June 2017 on Monocle 24.
You're tuned in to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One in London. I'm Andrew Tuck. On today's show, chaos in Westminster.
Look, we have a chaotic situation with a government that sought re-election on the basis of wanting a bigger mandate and a bigger majority to bring stability to British politics. And what have we got? A minority government relying on the DUP to try and get business through the House of Commons when they have no agreed position, as far as I can work out, on most issues. It seems to me chaotic.
Britain's Labour opposition paints itself as part of an alternative coalition as the Prime Minister's grip on power weakens. Meanwhile, in Washington.
The President tweeted on Friday, after I got fired, that I better hope there's not tapes. I woke up in the middle of the night on Monday night, because it didn't dawn on me originally, that there might be corroboration for our conversation. There might be a tape.
Despite being broadcast on national television, testimony by the former FBI director has provided bait and banter for fake news enthusiasts everywhere. We'll examine the state of America's quest for the truth. Plus, Qatar's diplomatic row worsens, and could Puerto Rico become the newest United State? That's all ahead on Midori House, starting right now. So welcome to Midori House, and my guest today are Jane Kinnamont, who's Senior Research Fellow and Deputy Head of the Middle East and North Africa Programme at Chatham House, and Foreign Affairs Analyst Tim Marshall. Welcome both to the programme. Now, we all know it was supposed to turn out how it was supposed to turn out, but Britain's Prime Minister Theresa May should have been spending this week setting out her agenda for Britain's future outside of the European Union, and with a healthy majority and both hands on the steering wheel. Then it all went horribly wrong. Today, Theresa May is holding on to the top job by the slimmest margin. Her tie-up with the controversial Democratic Unionist Party has been widely criticised. The Queen's speech, which should have set out the government's mandate, has been postponed. And the delicate Brexit negotiations look like to be in deep trouble before they've even started. Tim, it's quite hard to work out exactly where we are at the moment. Theresa May has met her MPs today and has taken the blame for it, but says that she will sort this mess out. Do you think that's likely, or do we still think she'll be gone in a matter of months?
Matter of months. I don't think we're the sick man of Europe, but I think we're the confused man of Europe. It is a bit of a car crash. The previous Prime Minister held a referendum on Brexit, which was not necessary, and lost it. This Prime Minister has held a general election, which wasn't necessary, and has only just marginally won it and plunged us back into confusion. The Conservative Party will not forgive her, but they're too frightened to ditch her right now in case there's another snap election and they lose it if Labour has the momentum. So, I mean, look, we're guessing, but my gauging of the mood, and I was in Westminster today, is that they will hang on with her. They will try to form this alliance with the DUP, which is very problematic. And then they will try to govern for a few months. And then once people get used to the idea that they are still the government, they'll ditch her and have a new leader.
Jane, what's intriguing is, you know, that in a way before this election happened, the feeling was that Labour was in a no-win situation. Because if they said, okay, we're going for Brexit as well with, you know, all of our heart, and, you know, Corbyn tried to kind of edge around it a little bit, they would lose the kind of the liberal lefties who kind of wanted to stay within the European Union. And if they said, do you know what, we're going to, you know, definitely remain, they would annoy the potential UKIP voters that they needed to bring back in the fold. They kind of managed to negotiate that quite well. Theresa May is the one that's in a tricky position. We look at this DUP deal. She's lost many liberal constituencies who didn't like what she was talking about Brexit. She has no chance of winning them back if she's seen to be, you know, in hock with the party, which has very scant regard for any kind of equal rights for gay people, is opposed to abortion, and has other murky kind of social views. She's in a tricky spot, whatever she does, isn't she?
She absolutely is. And it's fascinating how Brexit, which is the major issue facing the UK, was largely absent from the election campaign, which was mainly about other issues. The DUP certainly don't reflect majority opinion either on the left or the right when it comes to any social issues. Mm. But interestingly, having a party that does want less of a hard line on Brexit might at least reflect the opinions of quite a large constituency. Given that 48% of the country did vote for Britain to remain, and a fair chunk of those who voted for Brexit, including some of the senior ministers such as Boris Johnson, were in favour of remaining in the single market, then having something that is less extreme than the previous government seems to be outlining might be more democratic in some ways.
But do you think this tie-up with the DUP has risks in it as well?
It certainly does. I was in Scotland over the weekend and it's been interesting to see these proposals to make the Scottish Conservatives, who before Ruth Davidson emerged were almost entirely non-existent, into a separate party. And that partly reflects the differences between Ruth Davidson's leadership and the leadership of the Conservatives in England, who are happy to get into a coalition with a socially very, very, very right-wing party like the DUP.
And Tim, what we're seeing today is a suggestion that many of the elements were in the manifestos, and many of them didn't go down very well, including the so-called dementia tax. But even things like Theresa May's desire to drop the ban on fox hunting, all these things are to be forgotten. Again, the fox hunting thing is oddly a tiny issue, but it shows how she allowed her attention to be pulled away from the key issues. If she was worrying about fox hunting, but she wasn't worrying about really how old people would be cared for.
And fox hunting shows tone deafness. It is, I mean, personally I'm not in favour of it, but let's face it, it is probably a peripheral issue for most people. And yet it's an emblematic emotional issue. So if she suddenly decides that she's going to put fox hunting, make it legal again, half of the country on what is actually a peripheral political issue goes, oh, that's not very nice. When there was absolutely no need to go there and open it up during an election campaign, just park it. And this goes back to what I'm most interested in. There's two strands to this. One is the international strand vis-a-vis Brexit. And that I assume your international listeners are most interested in. And yes, now it's harder to push a hard Brexit through. On the domestic level, it was Mrs. May herself who spent years trying to detoxify the Conservative Party. She's the one who first admitted they were called the nasty party. And suddenly they're going to go into an alliance with a party that some of whom as MPs believe the earth is 6,000 years old, who are against gay marriage, etc., etc. Now, I don't think they'll push these agendas, but the fact of the branding, she's risking the Tory party being thought of as the nasty party again, and modern Britain is nowhere near that.
Yes, because whatever you think of David Cameron and his team, I think he genuinely was, pro-diversity.
He brought in gay marriage.
And on race issues and all sorts of things, he was widely regarded as being a very kind of straightforward person to deal with. But when you say it's going to be more difficult to have a hard Brexit, but we still have David Davis in the same job, who's pro a hard Brexit. We still have Boris Johnson in the same spot. And we've seen Michael Gove brought back into the government, one of the biggest campaigners for Brexit. Do you really think a hard Brexit is less likely now?
I think the war about it will continue. Whereas if she'd had an overwhelming majority, she'd have just driven through and done pretty much what she wants. She's got this tiny minority. The whole issue is going to come back onto the front burner. I'm not convinced by Mr. Johnson. Her new chief of staff is an ardent Remainer. She was a Remainer. I just think that, again, this tactical catastrophe of calling this election and not winning it overwhelmingly means that the issues that would have been put to bed, or at least on the back burner, are now back.
Yeah, fascinating image, an issue rather that has kind of torn apart the Tory party for many years, kind of back on the agenda. Jane, on this issue of how it plays out internationally, we've heard today that it's likely that the beginning of the talks about Brexit will be delayed, partly because of the Queen's speech. Other leaders in Europe just must think this is a kind of a no-hope nation, isn't it?
It becomes a really complex chess game because you're trying to weigh up the internal divisions within the Labour and Conservative parties, which are significant, with the different games that different European states are likely to be trying to play in these negotiations. But in some ways, if they have a Conservative government that is no longer so committed to walking away, to Theresa May's previous line that no deal was better than a bad deal, it might be worth trying to make some progress on negotiations now. Against that, there'll be others in Europe who are saying, this is a lame duck prime minister. Yeah. There's no point making progress with her. She'll be gone in 6 months. Let's wait it out.
And Macron looks like he's going to get his majority to govern as president and with parliament. I think Mrs. Merkel is going to win in October. And you've got the Brits staggering. I was in Sweden last week, and it was like the Swedes was thinking, what are you doing? And I think that is what Europe is thinking.
Well, I think it's amazing when you're in Europe that nobody's worried about Britain. Everyone's just kind of getting on with their lives and running Europe. They're kind of
how dare you?
Yeah, they're kind of indifferent to our issues where we think they should be on the
they're
front.
They're cut off from us. They just don't realise it yet.
Okay. But Jane, when you look at that, it is fascinating. So over the months when we've met you here in the studio, we've talked about kind of the risks for the Netherlands, the risks for Austria, the risks for France. The only two places that embraced populism with gusto were the Brits around Brexit and obviously the election of Donald Trump. Do you think if those events had come in a different order, if we'd had Donald Trump in Washington and Europe had been so aghast at his behaviour and seen how damaging the standing is to your country and to your reputation if you go down that route, that maybe people have been more cautious around the Brexit issue?
It would have made it more difficult to make the argument that Britain could forge ahead with a kind of Anglosphere alliance. Although at the same time, Donald Trump could only be in power for a maximum of 8 years, and even 8 years looks fairly unconvincing. So it's relatively short term compared to how long term a decision Brexit is. The vote was very close, though, at the end of the day. Many factors could have made it go differently, including higher turnout.
And Tim, just before we move on, Donald Trump said he's not coming. He doesn't like the idea of being kind of booed on our streets. But for Theresa May, that's another bit of a disaster, isn't it? Because we have in our memory bank a very clear image of the two of them holding hands. Mm. And that image, like a nasty nightmare, will not go away. That is the image that is sealed. When you think of the two of them, that is the image that's in your mind. The sealing of this special relationship that she rushed to endorse. And nothing seems to be coming from it. Now he doesn't even want to come and see her and the Queen. Do you think he's pulling out from that makes it clear that there is no kind of real worry about kind of making a special deal with the Brits?
I don't think there is, no. I think what he wanted more than anything was a selfie with the Queen. If it took a visit, great. Look, the latest thing that came out, I mean, it's only a minor thing, very juvenile and minor. There's a movement getting up that wants to bare their buttocks to Mr. Trump if he comes. And if I know the Brits, there would be hundreds of people dropping their trousers as the carriage passed. Well, it's not the sort of image he wants.
It's a great loss to political protest, though. The opportunity that this visit would have presented.
Jonathan Swift would have loved it, the great British
Well, I think we
writer.
Had the naked bike ride here in London at the weekend, which hundreds of people turned out for. So they've got some willing people to drop their trousers here in London anyway. Now, the chances of the Labour Party's Jeremy Corbyn establishing an alternative coalition are very slim, some say impossible. There is, however, a very real chance of another election, which could see the Labour Party perform even better, perhaps. Well, let's imagine that for a moment then. What would Britain's exit from the European Union look like under a government led by Jeremy Corbyn? Tim, do you think that he would...
Could you ask another guest first? Because I have no idea.
When you look at Corbyn, again, he's quite hard pinned down on this issue. We'll go to Jane. We're going to give you a rest because I think Jane's probably got a better idea. Do you think it would be an easier negotiation? Well, first of all, the Europeans might be more welcoming of him because he's not Theresa May. But do you think he would go for a more of an attempt to stay within the single market? Because he's also said many times he's not that worried about the migration question.
True.
And he might be more likely to make a compromise on that.
He would be inheriting a massive problem because he is generally believed to have been supportive of Brexit himself, although he was supposed to be campaigning against it. But his party and many of the new voters they attracted this time round were certainly against Brexiting. He would be coming in, had he won, as the leader of the largest social democratic party in Europe. So he would certainly have sympathy from social democratic parties right across. And probably then reaching some kind of deal on immigration wouldn't be so difficult, even though at heart he's probably not much of a free trader.
No,
I do have a view. I'm sorry. I just couldn't imagine it for a moment because look, I'm not tribal in my politics. I'm not left or right. But I do think that the current Labour leadership are incompetent. And I do not think and see that the brain power and the nous at the international level, even with the backing of the civil service, is necessarily there to really get stuck into proper negotiations. And if they do form a government, I hope I'm wrong.
Do you think, this is an interesting point, you know, I think many people I've spoken to over the last few days, this is almost for a kind of, you know, to be honest, a monocle kind of listener who is probably, you know, I'm guessing here, I think the majority were probably Remainers, probably most of them feel themselves, you know, pretty urban, pretty, you know, used to diversity, all those things. So they feel comfortable with how life was pre the Brexit vote. Do you think that this was almost like the perfect election result for those people? Because in a way, they didn't kind of want Jeremy Corbyn to be their prime minister, but they certainly wanted Theresa May to be taught a lesson. So they were in a dilemma, and it couldn't have been better because, you know, they have her certainly pressured to potentially leave. They have question marks against the whole Brexit negotiations, but they don't actually have to pay, like, you know, another 20% tax.
Yes, yes, and yes. But I think the result was that was only a smaller of the factors. I think it was that it was fought on domestic issues, whereas the Tories tried to fight it on Brexit. I think that vehement Remain vote, some of it went to the Liberal Democrats, who didn't do particularly well, but did okay for them. No, I think it was the youth vote, the terrific campaign that the Labour did, the social media campaign really outshone. It's almost as if the Labour Party had learnt more from Donald Trump's campaign than the Conservative Party had, because on social media they were front and centre.
We're going to move on, but we should remember he did lose.
Yeah.
And he lost by quite a big margin, and, you know, in most of the circumstances people would be calling for his head, but it was because he had such kind of shocking numbers against him. But Jane, do you think momentum in every sense of the word is with him at the moment? Do you think that if there was another election in 6 months, he would be a potential PM?
Who knows what is going to happen over the next 6 months? It's certainly a lesson that starting with low expectations is a big advantage. But had the election taken place a month earlier or a month later, it might have looked a lot worse for Jeremy Corbyn. What he is going to be now is the strong opposition leader that he's never been able to be before. And so there will be a lot of pressure on the weak government.
And he's going to have a smile on his face, that's for sure. He's been smiling ever since that election. Well, you're listening to Midori House, here with me, Andrew Tuck, Jane Kinnamond, and also Tim Marshall. Coming up next, we'll look at how the seeds of fake news are planted, plus Qatar calls on international leaders for help, and will Puerto Rico be the next United States? Stay tuned.
Are you an entrepreneur, architect, city maker, shop owner, media player, property developer, or chef? Then you need a ticket to the most important conference on delivering quality of life in our cities. The Monocle Quality of Life Conference is back, and this year is touching down in Berlin. Join us from the 29th of June to the 1st of July for great debate, informative panels, engaging hospitality, and a chance to see the best of Berlin. Join us as we discover the developers who are rethinking the property world, how you can build stores that work in a click-and-shop world, what the most inspirational entrepreneurs are planning, how you make a hit restaurant or fragrance firm, the media brands to watch, how we can green our cities, the future of transport, and much more besides. Let's make better places to live. Join us. Be inspired. The Monocle Quality of Life Conference 2017. Head to conference.monocle.com to book your ticket.
You're back with Midori House. I'm Andrew Tuck, and still with me are Jane Kinnamont and Tim Marshall. Now, Ivanka Trump says her father, the US president, of course, Donald Trump, is feeling vindicated following testimony by former FBI director James Comey last week. There were echoes of the president's own review of Comey's testimony during Ivanka's appearance on the Fox News Network today. It may seem like a strange way to describe what many saw as a dark moment for American democracy, but it's part of a wider partisan gap between mainstream media and the right-leaning press, which has seen conspiracy theories and falsities gain widespread attention. Now, one of these stories is a tweet that was put up by a pro-Trump conspiracy theorist, which seems to have kind of taken fire, which is just tweeting the fact that, you know, the Comey had said that he hadn't done anything wrong when he hadn't said that at all, and off it goes into the ether and changes the agenda of news channels.
Yeah.
Tim, you know about the news agenda. You know how these things happen. What do you make of the way that this story, and like many other stories around Trump, is being reported, actually by quite serious news organizations, yeah, by the likes of Fox, who are picking up on chatter, not looking at the facts?
And it is symptomatic of the rise of social media that so many people take it so seriously, and simultaneously the rise of the 24-hour news cycle and journalists either feeling they haven't got time or being too lazy to check things. It is new, but at the same time, there's been variations of it. I mean, I was in a newsroom for nearly 30 years. They wouldn't let me out. I can remember several times there'd be a story, a headline, and you'd read the headline, and then you go and look at the story that it came from. And then if you traced it back to the actual speech that had been made and the words that were used, sometimes there was a bit of a wiggle room. You'd have to go back and say, hang on a minute, that headline's not quite correct, and get it corrected. Because there are checks and balances, and people in the mainstream media, contrary to popular belief, are mostly very responsible people. So that was always going on. What you've got now are a lot of very irresponsible people, some of them sitting in their underpants with beer cans in their rooms with just a white glow from the screen on their face, putting stuff out there, which is believed by a lot of people because, yes, the MSM have had problems in the past, but also because the MSM is picking it up, as you say, and sometimes repeating it, instead of saying, let's hone in on this, let's fact-check it, let's stop for a moment. And there's not enough of that going on.
Jane, is it a failure just of journalism, the art of journalism, that, you know, actually, in the past, people would have been hauled up in front of their, and people have said, you know, what's going on? How did you report this? But now it's seen as entertainment. It's seen as one of those things. It's fun almost to kind of distort the news.
Right. I guess it's about business models as well, that, you know, people like to pay for content that reinforces and reflects their own biases. And a lot of networks then have an interest in people who just make others feel comfortable by repeating, you know, Trump's done nothing wrong, the liberal media have been conspiring against him, etc., etc.
But there's double blame here. There is the blame of the mainstream media for not checking often enough and actually laying to rest myths. But there is also that, yeah, there are these people out there on social media deliberately feeding stuff in. You know, they are, they'd love to be called hooligans, I suspect. But, you know, they're rather sort of cheap and creepy, but they exist. And because so many people, as you rightly point out, are in the echo chamber, think, oh, yeah, that's great, I'll repeat it. I won't even sit down for a moment, which is why the criticism of the mainstream media has been overdone.
I don't agree with that, because I think those people do exist.
I don't care. I only want to hear my opinion.
That's right. Those people are bound to exist. And sometimes, in this case, when I first read it, I thought maybe the guy's just been sloppy. Maybe he didn't read the testimony properly. Other times you'll get people who are propagandists. You'll get foreign governments deliberately trying to distort the truth. If the social media is open, that's bound to happen. So the buck needs to stop somewhere.
Yeah, and it's just the speed at which it happens, and the speed at which it becomes record in certain news organisations. That becomes their baseline for the next piece of reporting as well. We're going to have to move on, though, because I've got two more stories for him before the end of this show. We want to go to Qatar, where there are further signs of strain today, with the nation's foreign minister holding an urgent meeting with his British counterpart. It's understood he'll ask Boris Johnson to condemn an air embargo imposed on the Gulf state. Qatar is facing diplomatic and economic isolation from its neighbours over allegations that it supports terrorism. Jane, a proper, as we say, you know, very holy mess in all senses. Now, is there any way out of this for Qatar? without kind of giving up on Al Jazeera, without giving up on many of the things that it needs and believes in?
Yes, I think its Gulf neighbours, Saudi and the UAE, have probably overplayed their hand for two reasons. One is that most of the other governments who take an interest in this know that this isn't really about terrorism. It's mainly about differences over foreign policy towards the Muslim Brotherhood and Iran, which are differences between the Gulf states in which the Western countries don't have that big a direct stake. The second thing is that Qatar is the country with the third largest gas reserves in the world. So even the UAE, which has largely imposed this embargo on Qatar, is still continuing to import gas from Qatar because it needs to do that. Similarly, the UK is a massive consumer of Qatar's liquefied natural gas, which provides about 15% of Britain's household gas. Qatar does have friends for economic reasons, and the charge sheet against it in terms of supporting dodgy groups is not as strong as all that to outweigh those economic alliances. Boris Johnson may well simply follow the US lead, which is to say, hey, this embargo on the country that hosts the US main airbase in the region is actually no good for the fight against terrorism. So rather than saying we utterly condemn it, he can say it's not actually useful in our view.
Just quickly, Tim, do you think one of the reasons that they haven't turned off that gas is because they're concerned that they may see what happened in Bahrain and tanks come across the border and say, actually, you can't turn off the gas?
This is not a time to inflame this situation. £40 billion worth of investment into the UK by Qatar will concentrate Boris Johnson's mind, but I agree with what's been said before. Qatar does have some cards to play, but this blockade really is quite tough. It will hurt them. I can't see them getting into bed with Iran on a long term. The Iranians are now flying planes of food in, but I can't see that being sustainable. So the way out is Qatar makes some sort of public statement that saves face and they get back to a very uneasy relationship. But it is really, they've been washing their dirty linen in public. It's quite unusual.
Well, finally tonight, hopes are high in Puerto Rico that it might be on track to become the newest United State of America. A referendum held at the weekend found that 97% of voters supported being the unincorporated territory becoming the 51st state. Puerto Rico's governor will formally ask Congress to admit Puerto Rico into the union, but several hurdles lay in his path. Not least, only 23% of people voted. Jane, do you think that Mr. Trump will have time for this or any desire to see them become another state?
It's up to the US Congress at the end of the day, and given how poor Puerto Rico is, it's quite hard to see anyone really having a strong interest in this. But perhaps it's something that can be repeated around the world. Perhaps if Brexit goes really badly, we could have another referendum.
Oh, we could be the 51st.
You know, try and sign up, yeah.
I think, actually, I don't want to be 51st.
But Puerto Rico won't be.
You think that the government in D.C. will just turn it down?
Puerto Rico, as you probably know, means rich port. It isn't. It's extremely poor. They don't want it. It's poorer than Mississippi, the poorest state in the union already. Yes, they are U.S. citizens, but they don't get to vote. But the U.S. just doesn't need it. Congress isn't interested. Trump isn't interested. It's an interesting news item because it tells you about this place that usually we don't know much about. Move on. Sorry.
But do you think that for Puerto Ricans who, you know, they've faced bankruptcy of the country in recent years, they've faced all sorts of hurdles, what does it mean for their future if they're left in this limbo?
I mean, obviously, there's, 5.5 million of them, and obviously it's very serious for them. The biggest point was only 23% voted. So most people just didn't bother. I think it was 8 out of 10 or whatever the leader, the deputy leader said. What it means is, because they are citizens but not a state, is that they don't get any funding from federal government, and that has kept them in poverty. So you'd actually think that more people would come out and vote and say, I want to be a state. But in fact, no, they have a sense of their own marginal independence, despite being, what's the word, protectorate?
Commonwealth.
Well, no, you're right, they are a commonwealth, but so is Virginia. I've got it somewhere, an unincorporated territory since 1898.
Well, a little bit of a history lesson for you as well today, but that's all we have time for on Midori House. Thanks to our guests, Tim Marshall and Jane Kinnamont. And today's show was produced by Ben Ryland. It was researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Fiametta Sasana. And our studio manager was Toby Hammond. More music next, and at 1900 Hours is Culture with Robert Bound. and we'll have more on the day's main stories on the Monocle Daily at 2200 hours. Midori House is back at the same time tomorrow. That's 1800 hours London time. But from me, Andrew Tuck, thank you very much, and thank you for listening.